Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy. I'm pleased to bring to you the eighth and final Mishnah in Perek Aleph, and then we'll continue on to Perek Bet of the Masechet of Bava Metzia for OU's Mishnayot Yomi program. In Mishnah Chet, the Mishnah continues to discuss one finding legal documents. However, in the following cases, the documents can indeed be returned to the stated owner, since there's no concern for financial shenanigans or other complications, which we saw in the previous Mishnah. Matzai Igeret Shum, one who finds an appraisal of the real estate, which is used to guarantee a loan. As we mentioned, a loan can be, when one borrows money from another, one can guarantee it with a lien against property. Apparently there was another document called an Igeret Shum, which included an appraisal of said property that was used for the lien on the loan. V'igeret Mazon, which is a document that confirms that a husband takes responsibility to feed, either, according to some opinions, his wife's daughter, that is a daughter from another marriage, or that he's selling his property to make sure that he can feed his wife and kids. But essentially it's a guarantee that the husband has taken responsibility to make sure that his family is fed. Shtarei Chalitza, okay, we better discuss this a little bit. When a woman loses her husband but has no children from him, the Torah essentially creates an automatic bond between her and the oldest, really, but one of the deceased, her deceased husband's brothers. And the goal of the Torah is that the Torah wants them to sanctify this bond, to actually create a marriage out of it, or what's called a yibum status out of it. And I think the goal essentially is to create or to continue on the lineage of the dead brother. That is, should the widow have a child from her dead husband's brother, that child would continue the line of the dead brother. Now, should none of the brothers want to accept her, and of course there's a possibility that she may not want to accept it, but the more common part is that they don't want to accept her for whatever reason, so the oldest must formally break the bond that was automatically created when his brother died childless. This process is called chalitza, and by breaking the bond, the woman receives a document which essentially states, that is, the process creates her status, frees her up to marry whoever she wants, and this document proves that, in fact, the chalitza was done and she's not bound to any of the brothers. Miyunin, if a person finds a miyunin document, now a young girl can be given a marriage, I don't want to say against her will, because she doesn't have much will at this age, but it can be given in marriage without her consent by her mother or her brother. However, the girl, as soon as she achieves some state of knowledge, although still considered to be a young girl, at some point before she comes of age, she could say, I simply don't want to be married to this person, and therefore this relationship is broken. She does not need a divorce, since the relationship was not a true marriage in the first place. This rejection is called a miyun, and if one finds a miyun, one gives it to her to prove that she did in fact reject this person and is no longer required to neither marry her nor get a divorce from him or get a divorce from him. Shtarei Birurin. It's an interesting document. Livror means to choose. And essentially, it's a little bit like jury selection. Two people have a legal dispute. One accepts one rabbi, his favorite rabbi / judge, who will rule in the case. Another person picks his own jurist, and they both must agree on a third jurist / rabbi / judge who will decide the case. This selection and approval process is documented shtar birurim, and should it be found, it should be returned to them. V'chol maaseh beitin harizei achzir, and any other document which is exercised by the court themselves, all of the aforementioned may be returned to the person that is listed as the recipient on the document. The Mishnah goes on to explain another condition where a found legal document may be returned to, well, we'll see to whom it's supposed to be returned. Matzah b'chapiso b'duluskuma tachrich shel shtarot o agudah shel shtarot harizei achzir v'kam agudah shel shtarot shloshak shurim zeh bazeh. So if a person finds a legal document in a pouch or a leather sack, or the documents are bundled together or linked together with some kind of tie, in all these cases, the documents may be returned. Now, Rav Bartnur explains to whom are they returned? They're returned to the person who can make an identification on that pouch or sack or the way it's been tied together, which is why the Mishnah explains that the bundle or the tie must be at least three deep, because one needs it to be that three deep in order to be distinctive enough to be identified by the person who owned those documents or had them in his possession legally. And while we're talking about sets of three, creating identification to whom documents belong, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, Echad halove mishloshe yachzir lalove. So, if one finds three debt documents grouped together, not tied together, but three documents in the same basic area, and they all have the same borrower, that is, they're coming from different lenders, but they all have the same borrower, so then you can return them to the borrower, which of course legally decides that he's paid off the debt. Otherwise, he wouldn't have those documents. A borrower only gets them after he pays off the debt. The question, it becomes obvious, though, that is according to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, if you find three documents, they all have the same they all have the same borrower, then it's quite clear that they fell out of his pocket, because otherwise how would the documents that were in the possession of three different lenders happen to find themselves into one little pile that somebody would find? The Talmud does add a stipulation. It says there may be a situation where three separate lending documents may be found, and yet it doesn't belong to the borrower. And that's if that's before the documents are certified by the courts. Now, because if they were not certified by the courts, then it's possible that three different lenders brought them to a single court to get them certified, and one of the court scribes was holding on to these three from the three different lenders and dropped them, and therefore the debt was never paid off, even though they all have the same lender on them. Conversely, shlosha halovim me echad yachzir lemalveh. If three debt documents are found and they all belong to one lender, but obviously from different borrowers, they are returned to the lender. Again, the idea is that the great probability or almost certainty is that they fell out of the pocket of the lender, since they are from three different borrowers. But once again, there is a proviso, which is if the same scribe's handwriting is on all three, then we have to assume that it's a possibility that the scribe dropped them. And in fact, we have no idea whether the loan was ever made. That is, they could have just been in the scribal process, being written, but never actually being delivered in a court setting with a recognition that a loan was made and has to be paid back. They could have been three theoretical documents all written up by the same scribe. And therefore, if you find them, even though they all belong to the same lender, one cannot be certain that the lending actually took place. And as we said, a motzi mechaver ola varaya, and therefore the documents do not go back to the lender. Matza shtar bein shtar otav ve'eno yodea mativo yehi munach ad sheavo Eliyahu. So this is a new case. If a person finds a debt document belonging to two other parties, the reason why he probably has it is because one of the parties trusted him with the document and said, you know, I can't keep hold of this. You have a nice little safe on your wall. You hold it. The problem is he doesn't remember who he was holding it for. Perhaps he got it from the lender for safekeeping, in which case the loan has not yet been paid. Or perhaps he got it from the borrower and the loan was repaid. So the Mishnah decides that the document stays in stasis until Eliyahu, Elijah, the prophet, comes. And that essentially means that only prophecy can determine its truth, and therefore it's not so much that the debt it no longer exists, the loan no longer exists, but the document is frozen and the loan is frozen in time as well. Not canceled, but frozen until some prophecy reveals the truth. The next case, according to the Gemara, is not an extension of the previous case where a third party had the document, even though the word im, which begins it, sort of indicates that it is. Nonetheless, the Talmud says that it's a brand new case. It's not a third party that has the document, but the lender himself. Im yesh imahem sumponiot yasem masha sumponiot. So if a lender finds among his documents a receipt of loan payoff. Now, so there are essentially two ways to indicate that a loan is paid off. One is to deliver the debt document over to the lender. The other one is that to the borrower, and therefore by the fact that the borrower has the debt document means that he paid off the debt and received the debt document in return. The other way is for the lender to keep the document, to rip the document, and the borrower gets a sumpon, or a receipt essentially that says that the debt has been canceled. Now, normally, the debt document itself should have been ripped up among the other ripped up canceled debts of the lender, and the borrower should have his hands on the sumpon. Nonetheless, if the lender has the loan document as well, even though it's not ripped up, and he has the sumpon, he has to assume that he, in fact, the loan was paid off, and he simply forgot to rip up the loan document and give the sumpon to the ex-borrower. That is, the ex-borrower probably called him up and said, listen, you know, I trust you. Hold on to the sumpon for a while until I get a chance to pick it up from you. And therefore, once the sumpon is written and found, therefore we must assume that the debt was paid off. That ends the last Mishnah of Perek Aleph, and we now continue with the first Mishnah of Perek Bet. The first Mishnah in the second Perek, or the second Perek itself, deals with the law of Hashavat Aveda, Hashavas Aveda. The Torah requires that if an item is found, that one who finds it not only does not get immediate ownership of it, but in fact he must pick it up and he must attempt to return it to the owner, including making a public notice that an item has been found. And if the owner cannot be immediately found, the item must be kept safe by that person until the owner can be found. The only way the item may be kept by its finder is if that item has no distinguishable characteristics, and, at least according to the way the Talmud discusses the issue, or decides the issue, the owner must recognize that it is lost. That is, it's a two-step process. First, the owner must recognize that it's lost, and then the owner has what's called yush, or gives up all hope, because he knows that the item has no distinguishable features, and therefore he gives up ownership through this process of yush, and that puts it into the public domain or hefker, and then, and only then, do we say finders keepers. So the mission defines first two possibilities: elu mitziot shelo ve'elu chayav lachriz. There are items which are found which one can keep, and there are items which are found which the finder must publicly advertise for their owner to come and identify it. Elu mitziot shelo. It now goes through a series of items that, in fact, a person can keep, because A, the owner would recognize that they were lost, and B, the owner would recognize that there is no way they'll be able to get them back because there's no distinguishable sign. So, elu mitziot shelo, matza perot mefuzarim, maot mefuzarot, krichot birshut harabim, viigulei dvela, kikarot shel nachtom, machruzot shel dagim, v'chatichot shel basar, v'gizei tsemer haba'om mimedinatan, v'anitzei pishtan, ulushanot shel argaman, hari elu shelo divri Rabbi Meir. So Rabbi Meir says the following items could be kept, meaning the owner essentially has been mi'aesh, she's given up all hope. First, scattered fruit. And the fact that they're scattered indicates that there's no way for the owner has any hope of repossessing them. There's no identifying sign to them. Or scattered money, or wound up sheaves of wheat, and they're small specifically, and they're found in a public place, and therefore they have no identifying characteristics, and there's so many people who are leaving them behind, there's no way to tell one person from another's. Also, rounds of dried figs. We now dry our figs in sort of a, they always come in a line and kind of like a thin box, but they used to be dried in kind of a circle. I always picture it sort of like a wagon wheel. And since everyone used to press and store these figs in the same way, so there's no way to identify one from the other. Also, loaves of bread from a commercial baker, as they have no personal identification, sort of like dropping 50 Wonder Breads or Arnold's Breads, and there's no way to tell one from the other. A link of fish, which are attached in a very common way by a string. Cuts of meat, fleeces of wool that come directly from a wool exporting country. That means that they're unworked. We'll see in the next mission that if a wool was worked by an artisan, then it can be distinguished. Also, bundles of flax, bolts of colored wool. Now, the Mishnah specifies argaman because that is a very common color and therefore not identifiable. I guess if it's off fuchsia with orange spots, then one could say, yes, I could identify that. But just having a common purplish color bolt of fabric is not going to be able to allow things to be distinguished, and along with the rest of these things, they need not be returned because the finder returned by the finder, because the person who lost them knows they lost them, and they know that there's no way they can identify them. Now, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees not about these essential items, but about the following. Rabbi Yehuda omer kol sheyesh bo shinoi chayav lahachriz. Ketzad matzai gul v'tocho cheres kikar v'tocho ma'ot So then you would have to be machriz. Then you would have to announce it. You can't keep it for yourself. So he would agree essentially with Rav Meir, but he's saying that even if an item doesn't have a specifically an identifying feature, like somebody's initials or some kind of special way of being tied up, that would allow a person to identify. However, if there's something unusual about their state, then the unusualness is considered to be a distinguishing feature itself. So he gives two examples. One is a round of fig which has a piece of pottery. So I guess the person can come back and say, oh, I lost a round of figs. And the guy says, what does it look like? He says, well, it looks like a round of figs, but I accidentally broke a piece of pottery in it. Or loaves of bread, which normally are undistinguishable, but there's a coin among them. Or perhaps it means a single loaf with a coin embedded in it. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, kol klei anforia ein chayav lachriz. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar adds that any newly purchased utensil becomes a property of the finder. The reason is that even though the item may have identifiable characteristics, because it's so new to the owner would not be able to recognize them anyway. That's a klei anforia, meaning one right from the shop. The addition that the Mishnah is adding here is that usually an owner has to specify the identifiable feature. That is, the person who found it doesn't say, oh, by the way, who lost a watch with, red dots all over it? Because then anybody will say, oh, I did. So what he does is he just says, who lost a watch? And the person has to come and say, mine was the one with the red dots. However, with the Talmud Chacham, with a person of great Torah knowledge, and the assumption is also a behavior to live up to that great Torah knowledge, there is a higher level of trust. That is, one may walk over, or in fact, one should walk over to Talmud Chacham and say, oh, by the way, I lost a watch, and somebody lost a watch, and it has red dots. Is that yours? Because we trust the Talmud Chacham to say, yes, that's mine, and not lie and try to take possession of something that did not belong to them. However, what Rav Shimon ben Elazar is saying is that even by Talmud Chacham, when it comes to Kli Emporia, because there's no way that Talmud Chacham would recognize the item, since he just got home with it from the store and he didn't get a good look at it, it's brand new. So even a Talmud Chacham, where normally we would describe the item, we do not do so for a Klei Emporia, because it's simply too new for anybody to recognize. The Rambam adds the following, that is, all of this is when items are found individually, but if they were found two or more, that is, the number itself may be identifiable, such as, oh, I lost two watches, or I lost, two baseballs. And therefore, if there is more than one item, then the finder must publicize a loss. And in addition, the Rambam points out, Hashavas Aved applies to Jews. Now, one certainly can return an item to a non-Jew, and I would suggest that one probably should return an item, a lost item, to a non-Jew, since it's a Kiddush Hashem. However, the Torah demands that we go out of our way to pick up the lost item and to make sure it's returned only in the case where it's a Jew. And therefore, if the item is lost, say, in a place like Grand Central Station, which not only has a massive amount of people walking by, but the probability, the majority of them are non-Jews, so even if it has an identifiable marker, one is not commanded to attempt to return the item. Again, they probably could and should, but they are not commanded to do so. And so ends the first Mishnah of the second parak on the issue of Hashavat Avedah. We will continue with Hashavat Avedah when we pick it up next time in Mishnah Bet.